Bequests can take many forms and are usually the largest and most impactful gift a donor will ever make. Your bequest will help to ensure the programming WPFW has provided for almost 50 years will continue into the future. More info available by email at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or by phone at 202-588-0999, extension 344. Or you can let us know you've already included PFW in your plans through those same channels so we can add your name to our growing list of legacy listeners. We are listener supported. We are Jazz and Justice. And because of your support, we are WPFW.
At 89.3 FM, this is member supported. WPFW, Washington.
To this hour of We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, right here on WPFW Washington, 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org, a Pacifica Foundation radio station standing strong out of Washington, D.C., 50,000 watts, but our power comes from you, the listener. We are entirely listener supported. That has kept us alive and empowered with Jazz and Justice for over 48 years. And whether you're new or a regular listener, do become a supporter of this station because people like me will thank you. There are over 100 programmers that bring you Jazz and Justice in the hopes of building better communities, a better world, one broadcast at a time. In this hour today, we will do a focus on Black librarians. And to help us do that, Shanti Burns Simpson, who is the Director of Youth and Family Services at the D.C. Public Library, joins us. She previously served as an Associate Director for the Center for Education and Schools at the New York Public Library. And from 2020 to 2022, Ms. Burns Simpson served as the President of the Black Caucus of the American Library Association, where she advocated for diversity, equity, and inclusion within the library profession. She has also chaired the Committee on Diversity for the American Library Association and currently serves as a board member for the Freedom to Read Foundation. Ms. Burns Simpson, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, David, for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, it's a pleasure to have met you. I had the pleasure of being up in Philadelphia just recently and joining 14,000 librarians from across the country who mean to preserve culture for everyone. Let's start off with one of the most basic questions. How did you become a librarian? What's your journey?
Oh, well, I will tell you that my journey is pretty much similar to many librarians of color who came into the profession. I did not know that you needed to have a master's degree to be a librarian. So I started as a page. I started as a person who shelved books in the library. It was actually a summer job that my godmother got me at the New York Public Library many years ago. I don't want you guys to do the math, but it was a summer job that I never left. I was making more than minimum wage, more than what my fellow friends in high school who were working at McDonald's. I was like, well, I'm going to have to work because senior dues and prom and all this, I'm going to need, you know, to make some money. And I'm making more than what they would charge at a fast food restaurant. I said, so I'll just stay. So I worked the summer before my senior year, and then I just worked all the way through senior year of high school. And then I kept the job throughout college. My undergrad at college, I went to Long Island University, and I continued to work for the library. I graduated. Okay, well, you guys will be able to do the math. I graduated in 2001 with my undergraduate, and my bachelor's is in fine arts. I was a dance major. And I says, you know, nobody's going to come to New York to see shows. I mean, they just blew up the World Trade. And so I remember my supervisor coming to me and says, are you interested in going to library school? We have a trainee program, a librarian trainee program. And I said, I'll get back to you. And I got home and I told my parents about it. My mom looked at me and she says, a free degree? You better go. You better go.
Oh, my goodness.
So, yeah. So I went back to work the next day and I says, yes, I'm interested in being in the librarian trainee program. And so I went and I filled out the paperwork and I went to Queens College. I went full time, honestly. So I was working and I was going to school and they paid for my classes and they worked around my school schedule because that was part of the trainee program. And so that's how I became a librarian. I did not know that you needed to have a master's degree. And when I went to library school, I went and I took all of the adult reference and management courses. And when I was graduating, at that time, I was working at New York Public Library and they had what they called librarian seminars, and they had them broken up based off of the age range that you would support. And so they had a children's seminar, a young adult seminar, and an adult seminar. And so at the time I was graduating, they had the young adult seminar available. So I took the young adult seminar, and then I immediately took the adult seminar. And then when it was time for them to place me as a librarian, they said, you're going to go and work at the Port Richmond Library, which is a library out in Staten Island, New York, and you're going to be the young adult librarian. And I said, oh, no, no, no. I am an adult librarian. And they said, oh, did you take the young adult seminar? And I said, yes. They says, well, you got to go to Port Richmond and be the young adult librarian. And David, I will tell you that it was the best thing that could happen because I don't know why I wanted to be an adult adult librarian. I think I took myself way too seriously. But the kids, I love the teens. And I was getting their little brothers and sisters coming into the program as well. And that changed the trajectory of my profession Because after that, I had no desire to go and be adult reference librarian. I wanted to continue to support our youth. And in different capacities throughout the library sphere, I have done that. And so I'm just really thankful for the supervisor at the time that placed me and says, no, you're going to do this. Because I don't know if I would have stayed in the profession as long as I've done so far.
Well, I want to thank you for your service, particularly here in the District of Columbia. Anyone that walks into a library knows that the branches are highly attentive and highly active with our young people, from the littlest ones to teenagers and into young adulthood. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
The history of literacy, reading, the ability to write, for folks of African descent, for Black folk, has been a difficult one in these United States. There's so many laws I've referred to them, and my guests have referred to them in previous shows, where the harshest of social sanctions, even the worst of physical penalties, and legal and extra legal threats have disrupted basically the access to libraries. That being said, I wonder if you can include that in what your understanding of, or a basic overview of, the evolution of libraries, and how do Black folk fit in to that evolution, or don't fit in?
Oh, that's a great question, David. I know myself, and I know many Black librarians, the act of what we do is radical. Because remember, they didn't want us to know how to read. So the fact that we are providing literacy to folks of all nationalities, ages, it's a radical act. Is so I would say the evolution of libraries with the role of Black Americans, we have to think about the libraries in the United States have been have not always been, and I'm talking specifically about public libraries. They were not always the warm, welcoming spaces that many of us are used to. Libraries, public libraries, all libraries used to be segregated. And so this how we look at libraries now as gateways to knowledge and upward mobility was not true in the early history of American libraries. Black people, both enslaved and free, were excluded from having library services by law or by practice. And so the Black Caucus of the American Library Association, we started back in the 1970s to fight the segregation of what was happening in libraries. We went to the American Library Association and said that you cannot and should not have libraries be part of the association if they're not serving everyone.
Could I ask, the ALA's been around for quite some time. Why the 70s? Why not earlier? Were there other voices before that?
Well, I would say that there were Black librarians, they were going to the conference, but they were not allowed to stay in the conference hotels. They were not able to get the full experience of the conference like their white counterparts. And so there were folks like E.J. Josey, F.E. Lee Morris, A.P. Marshall. There was a bunch of them that were meeting in hotel rooms to get a game plan on how we were going to get everyone to be able to have the same experience when they're going to conference and be able to be served in our libraries across the country. So yeah, ALA has been around a long time. But sometimes you just have to get your ducks in a row to be able to be strategic to get what you want. And so
And
I'm
sometimes that
very,
happens over the long course of history, of
oh,
course.
absolutely. And I mean, honestly, the Black Caucus of the American Library Association, even though we started 55 years ago, we didn't become an official affiliate to the American Library Association until 1992. So exactly. So we were doing the work, and then it wasn't until we felt that ALA got everything, the services that we were asking for, correct, that we felt that we wanted to be associated, to be an official affiliate of the American Library Association. So
Well,
there, yeah.
yes, go ahead, please. I'm sorry.
No, I wanted to point out that there's just so much around the stuff where we talk about libraries that folks aren't aware of. And I think that that's what's so poignant about having our history told. And that's what's so great about the and I don't know if you were able to see a screening when you were in Philadelphia, David, but we have a Black librarian, Rodney Freeman, who has this great documentary that he's been working on for a while, called "Are You a Librarian?" And folks, I remember hearing some people ask, "Well, what made you come up with that title?"
We're
And
both giving signifying laughs to each other because there's some obvious reasons, of course.
oh, absolutely. Because and I could speak firsthand as being a manager in a library, and when folks say, "Well, I want to speak to the librarian," and they either bring them to you or you're already speaking with them and you're saying, "I'm the librarian," they're shocked because the stereotype is this little old white lady with the bun in her hair, glasses, tell you to shush. And so they don't want to really believe that you are the librarian, but we are, So I thought that that title was so spot on because the documentary covers the historical, not just the historical aspect of Black librarianship, but it does cover that as well as what is going on now and how it's so closely linked to what we've been working against for so many years.
Well, allow me to reintroduce you. We're talking to Shaun T. Burns Simpson. She's the Director of Youth and Family Services at the DC Public Library. And we're doing a focus on Black librarians. Libraries are so important to all of us. And people of African descent, Black folk, have played important roles. Again, Ms. Burns Simpson, thank you for being with us. As you point out, this long history to get a piece of justice, not just for the benefit of one group, but for all. And I would also say that if people dig into research on the university level, there were notable Black folk that proved themselves at research libraries and such. So the disjuncture between the world of the ivory tower and public libraries is a sad one in this case. I wonder where we should go with this in this regard. I'm obviously going to ask you about more mileposts and more pioneers, but first of all, just roughly speaking, how many librarians are there in the United States? I'm not quite sure, but and then importantly, how many members of the Black Caucus of the ALA.
I know I'm a librarian and I could very easily look it up and find the number of librarians in the country. I don't know it offhand, but I will say that out of the many librarians that we have in the country, only 7% of the actual number of librarians are Black librarians. We
Seven
make
percent.
7%, so we're not even close to half, unfortunately.
Yeah. My
And
guess is there are about 144,000 librarians in the U.S., by the way.
well, I'm not going to say yay or nay, but it sounds right about as I don't think you're too far off. But yeah, we only make 7%. And David, out of that 7%, I want to say it's less than 1% that are male. So we say black male librarians, they're like the unicorns in the profession. It's very very few. And if we talk about how many black male librarians are children's librarians, it's very, very, very small. But saying all of that, we know that representation matters. We talk about that a lot where we're talking about the books, but it also means a lot where we're talking about having students see themselves in the various professions. So it makes a difference for a student to say that they've had a black librarian. It makes a difference for a child to see a person of color be a doctor, a lawyer, any of these positions that you do have to get higher ed to hold the position. It makes a difference. And so we continue, and when I say we, I say the Black Caucus of the American Library Association, we continue to work on recruiting folks into the profession. But even with the recruitment, and we'll have folks graduate with the degree, they don't always stay in the profession, unfortunately, because if you could be the only one in the whole library. So, like I would say, for example, a school librarian, you could be the one person in the school building. You might feel isolated, you know? Or even if you're a librarian and you might be maybe in a rural library, you might be the one out of the whole staff. And so sometimes you might get that, you might feel that responsibility. I know some of my colleagues and I, and I'll use air quotes, we say it's the black and brown tax. Because then when it comes to what, Black History Month or anything that needs a different perspective, you're the person that has to do the work. Where we're information professionals. If you don't know it, you do the research and find out so you could
And
be
you're not
better in your
relegated
role.
to parochial or singular topics. Yes.
Exactly.
Well,
So,
let me do this. I'm very mindful that we're hitting the halfway point pretty quickly.
Oh, wow.
I like to just get you to respond to some historical mileposts and important pioneers. We talked about visibility and invisibility. Well, Washington's Belle DaCosta Green managed one of the most elite executive libraries of J.P. Morgan, and it was done basically her day-to-day operation was passing for being a white woman. We've been referring, and we're very proud of the District of Columbia. An integrated library came by way of the Carnegie Library. I'm going to be fast and loose with this history, folks. Hang on. So the first library in D.C. was, I believe, in the 1300 block of New York Avenue Northwest, and then Andrew Carnegie endowed a library in the Mount Vernon area, and he held firm to the principle that it must be integrated. And then, as I guess branches evolved in D.C., it may have followed. I don't think it's true totally across the board. But at least our first library is the Tacoma DC branch. And I believe that they probably operated on an integrated principle. I'm not entirely sure about that. As far as people, so we mentioned Ms. DaCosta Green, but Arturo Schomburg transformed the 135th Street branch which was known as the Negro Research Division, in New York City, in Harlem, into what became the library bearing his name, the Schomburg Library. I hope you talk a little bit about Dorothy B. Porter, or she's also referred to as Dorothy Porter Wellesley. And then I want to end with a hat tip to you, Shante Byrne Simpson. Ella Baker did similar work that you have been doing and what you're doing now when she did a tenure at the Schomburg Library, instructing young people and their mothers to empower them in the community. So there you have it. I wonder if you want to say a few more words before we get to our brief break.
No, Dave. I mean, David, I think we need to send you to library school. I think you need to be part of it, because I see you've been doing your homework, your research, sure. And I don't want folks to just look at this library history as separate from American history. This is American history. And there's a whole lineage of folks that have done great work that has made a difference to how we use our libraries today, how we learn today, how we do our research today. I mean, you talk about Dorothy Porter. I mean, before her, we only had two classifications in the Dewey Decimal System. So I want folks to not just say, oh, well, you know, this is good to know. This is like nerd information. No, this is American history. And many of the folks that we are naming, they were part of the civil rights movement. And let's not get it mistaken that this conversation around challenged books, banned books, the idea of taking these books off our shelves, this is not new. This has happened. And the reason why they keep going back to this, and I say same playbook, is because when you take our stories off the shelves, when you remove the stories that our kids can't see themselves in the books that they are reading, then again, going back to what we were talking about, having them see themselves as maybe being a doctor, a lawyer, a librarian, and put it out there, librarians are not making more doctors and lawyers are, but it's still a good profession. I would say
it's an honorable one.
Yes, it makes a difference for them to see themselves in the literature and know that they matter, that their stories, just as anyone else's stories, should be on our shelves.
And it mattered to Ronald McNair, who was denied access to the libraries and his native South Carolina, but he prevailed and resisted and became an astronaut with NASA, unfortunately, tragically, with the Columbia tragedy. He's no longer with us. But there are countless examples like this. Folks, you're listening to We the People. The hour is focused on Black librarians. Our guest is Shante Byrne Simpson. She is the director of Youth and Family Services at the DC Public Library, and we are happy to talk about the significant role that libraries, and Black librarians in particular, play in our communities. Part of our service to you is to bring you public service announcements. Let's take a short break, and I urge you to return with us as we continue our conversation. We'll be right back after this.
While Medgar Evers and Patrice Lumumba were not personally acquainted, their lives and struggles are often commemorated together due to the parallels in their commitment to fighting for the self-determination and liberation of African people. WPFW celebrates the centennial of this parallel vision with From Mississippi to the Congo, 100 Years of Lumumba and Medgar, Wednesday, July 2nd, noon until midnight on WPFW. Building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
To the White House, and we are going to deliver a message. Trump must go now.
This 4th of July, refusefascism.org is saying, don't celebrate Trump's fascist America. protest. Don't barbecue with family. While immigrant families are being ripped apart, troops are in the streets, elected officials are being threatened and arrested, and fascism is advancing. No, the lesson of history is that fascism must be defeated before it becomes too late. That is why on July 4th at 2 p.m. at Logan Circle, RefuseFascism.org will rally and then march to the White House to declare independence from Trump's fascist America in the name of humanity. Then, right in front of the White House, they will raise the biggest chant heard round the world.
Trump must go now!
Trump must go now!
Details and to get involved, RefuseFascism.org. Yeah!
And welcome back to We the People. I'm your host, David Weston. More importantly, I always ask you at this point to focus on our subject and our guests. Our focus is on Black librarians. Our guest is Shante Burns Simpson. Again, Ms. Simpson is the Director of Youth and Family Services of the DC Public Library. She's done previous service at the Center for Education and in Schools at the New York Public Library. She's a past president of the Black Caucus of the American Library Association, and she currently serves on the Committee on Diversity for the American Library Association and a board member of the Freedom to Read Foundation. Again, thank you so much for being with us. We ended on that ever dramatic note that's ever present with us. The fundamental realities that we're in the midst of a very messy cultural war going on, something that's been going on for some time. We will continue to talk about the challenges and opportunities that Black librarians and therefore our communities face. But what is the particular impact that you've observed or has been shared with you about the current affairs regarding banned or challenged books?
I would say the current waves of the book bans and challenges disproportionately target books by and about Black people and other marginalized communities. They're also looking at LGBTQ plus materials as well. But many Black creators, their books are being challenged and asked to be taken off the shelves. I would say that myself, my colleagues, we're often on the front lines of defending these books and the right for all of our communities to see themselves reflected in our collections. These challenges are not just about censorship. They're about whose stories are allowed to be told. And so thinking about what's being pulled off of different websites, as well as on our shelves, there is a huge censorship and an erasure of our stories.
If you allow me, I just wanted to set up a contrast. You talked about the categories of folks that have been targeted, for lack of a better way of putting it. Right away, as you were talking, I was thinking of All Boys Aren't Blue, which covers both Blackness and gayness. But this has been a longstanding tradition from The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn to Tony works of Toni Morrison, which it's kind of a subjective statement, but I think a mature teenage reader could certainly handle and benefit from Ms. Morrison's works. I cannot imagine a world without Virginia Hamilton and Jack Keats' Snowy Day. I deliberately mention these last two things because they are regaled, they're renowned, they're held in high esteem by all members of our society. And people identify with it. It's the power of the imagination, both to want to see yourself, but also it stretch the imagination and identify with others.
And I will point out that the Snowy Day was the most checked out book in the New York Public Library's history.
In fact, there's a commemorative stamp from the U.S. Postal Service.
Yes.
On that. And people love the short film. Yes, I'm sorry.
No. It's all good. And The Snowy Day was a Beyond the Book title. And Beyond the Book is a program that we have in D.C. Where we take amazing literature for kids. We use the artwork from the book and we wrap a library with that artwork. And so we had MLK had the Snowy Day mural on its building, and we had the artwork up in the children's room. Our next Beyond the Book will be unveiled later this month, and it is from Kwame Alexander, and it's called How to Sing a Song. And that the library that will be wrapping with that artwork will be the Tenley Friendship Library, and that will be later this month. But again, we want to highlight Black creators in this work, not just Black creators, but again, we want to make sure that all communities can see the different types of communities that we have within DC represented.
Well, you just gave me yet another bridge. Thank you. You mentioned Mr. Alexander, who at the ALI meetings in Philadelphia hosted and moderated a conversation with Dr. Carla Hayden, and sadly to say, the former Librarian of Congress. What was the impact of Dr. Hayden's abrupt firing? What observations and what reactions have you experienced with that?
I'm going to try not to get emotional, because it was great that we had Dr. Hayden in her role, because she was the first Black librarian in the role, and she was a librarian in the role. I think a lot of people assume that the Librarian of Congress has always been a librarian, and that's not true, unfortunately. The way that she was dismissed via an email is rude, disrespectful, all of the adjectives that you could think of without me saying any bad words.
Okay.
The thing about it is, I did speak to Kwame Alexander because we to talk about the planning of a program for him to come to Tenley Friendship, and it was the time where we found the news that she was no longer going to be the Librarian of Congress. And we both were on the phone call, and I want to say that we both expressed our sadness, our anger, and we didn't want to feel like helpless, if that makes sense. So
Dr. Hayden wouldn't allow that of any of us.
Exactly.
Quite encouraged.
You're absolutely correct. So we were talking about the Beyond the Book, and we were talking about, you know, Dr. Hayden's being let go. And so Kwame called me back, and it had to have been within the hour. And he said, you know, me, Jason, he's talking about Jason Reynolds.
Another rock star, by the way.
Walks
in a room, kids and adults go wild. I'm sorry, I couldn't help myself.
I mean, he does. If you haven't read a Jason Reynolds book, you better pick up one. And he said, Jackie, and he was talking about Jacqueline Woodson. He said, mm-hmm. You know, we're all available on May, I forget the date now, 30th or whatever. He says, you want to do something? And I'm like, what? He says, yeah, you want to do something. We're all available on the same day. And I said, give me an hour. And I called her back and I said, yeah, let's do something. And so we planned a town hall where we had, unfortunately, when it was time to do the program, Jacqueline Woodson was no longer available. But we had Kwame Alexander, we had Jason Reynolds, we had Meg Medina, we had Ibram Kendi. We had folks from Freedom to Read. We had folks from ALA. We just had all of the people from the different parties who could just like get to DC. And we just wanted to have a conversation of what is happening right now. And it was so powerful and it was recorded. You can find it on YouTube. You can find it on, oh my goodness, let me find the website because I do want your readers and your listeners to be able to watch it. But just the what we experienced, what we felt, just all being together and just being able to think out loud, we all said that this could not just be a one and done. And I am in agreement of that. We have to continue to have this conversation so that folks don't feel like we're just going to roll over and take whatever is happening at this time. But I just think it's just really important that we continue to have these conversations. That's why I really thankful to be on your show right now, because it's we all have to say what is happening and just really think about how it affects us, and it affects everyone differently, but it will have an effect.
Yes, indeed. To support that point, I'm just going to do a shout out. First of all, Dr. Hayden led the Enoch Pratt Library of the Baltimore area to greater heights and points of greatness. And so a shout out to our Baltimore friends who do hear us. As far as what is popular among kids and young readers, I just want to give a shout out. And I know I'm going to neglect somebody, Shante, forgive me. But Sharon Flake resonates with all sorts of students of all sorts of backgrounds here in the metropolitan area. Elizabeth Acevedo critical. And yeah, she's been very active both as a teacher and as a writer among young people. And Tomi Adeyemi has again expanded the world of fantasy and adventure with her trilogy. I deliberately mention these authors because in being about town and talking to folks, particularly young people, it's just altogether wonderful. I share the same pleasure as you. Well, let me do this. I'm going to reintroduce you and tell people several good reasons why they should be listening and supporting WPFW. Again, our focus is on Black librarians here at We the People. My guest is Shante Burns Simpson. She is the Director of Youth and Family Services at the D.C. Public Library and a past president of the Black Caucus of the American Library Association. You know, at any given hour, I'm mindful that we have new listeners and regular listeners. And it's because we bring you Jazz and Justice and have done so with listener support for over 48 years. At 3 o'clock, Sophie's Parlor, Music and Culture by one of the longest and oldest women collectives on public radio, and that they produce a show that's for everyone. At 2 o'clock, Shea Wanana with Zen El Amin covering Middle Eastern affairs. At 1 o'clock, Africa Now with host and producers Moisa Mutali and James Pope. They focus on African descended people, not only in the continent, but throughout the world, throughout the diaspora, whether it's the environment, politics, history, literature, or politics, they bring that to you. And every noon hour, especially during the week, They lead us into the weekend, but every noon hour, Don't Forget the Blues, the Wednesday edition by my distinguished friend, Clarence the Blues Man Turner. All these are good reasons and an expression of our thanks as programmers to you for listening and supporting WPFW.
David, I found the website.
And all right, so let's do a marker. You were referring to the website to do what, and what is the website?
Sure. So I'm referring to the website readstrongamerica.org. And so this website highlights all of the different programs that we will continue to do to just really highlight authors of color and being able to push out great stories that we want to make sure folks are aware of, so that when they're talking about banning books, taking these stories off the shelves, you know the story, you feel that connection, and you're not going to just be like, oh, okay, that's fine, because you're not aware. So readstrongamerica.org has the on the YouTube page, the program that we initially started at the DC Public Library at MLK, but it also highlights a program that was done with the Black Caucus of the American Library Association. That was the Juneteenth read-in. And there'll be additional programs that will be happening, and it will all be on this website, readstrongamerica.org.
Thank you for that. The time has gone by so quickly. Got about 7 minutes or so. The necessary generic question, but again, a necessary one. Tell us about the ever-expanding roles that Black librarians are going to have to play that you imagine in the future. And how can we interact with them for a better future for all of us? But how can we support libraries, librarians, and particularly Black librarians?
Okay. I would say that Black librarians are critical connections between our communities and institutions, between culture and literacy, between history and our future possibility. So engaging with Black librarians means supporting us, supporting our leadership, amplifying our voices, our work, working alongside us to co-create an equitable, informed, and inclusive future for all of us. I think we, I mean, David, you know, you walk down, you walk into a room and you see another Black person, that infamous nod. I want us to have that with our Black librarians. When you're going into a library and you see us, give us the nod, support our work.
When
they're thinking about going after, unfortunately, our jobs because they think that we're pushing pornography to kids, that's by far not what we're trying to do. And so I want you to, if you have questions, come to us, ask us what is happening. Ask us about a good story that you can share with your child. That's all we want to do. We want to be able to support giving materials, giving information that's viable information, because again, there's continuous fake news. And so we just want to make sure that whatever your information you're getting, it is correct. And we want to make sure that we are connecting you with the next story that you will enjoy and love. So work with us.
And allow the bifurcation for a moment. Nothing could be more wonderful and warm than the memory of a child growing into an adult by having a parent or a family friend or a place of worship member taking her or him or they to the library. It's a wonderful thing indeed. I imagine also, and I've got this inference from you when talking to you, that it's so important that some of the existing non-traditional institutions in vis-a-vis the library also maintain libraries and encourage and have active programs of reading. What have been some of the crucial touch points since you specialize in youth and family services? Please do say more about what you have found that's been critical and important over the last few years.
I will say that what's really crucial is that statistics have shown that kids who do well in school, who are, and I use air quotes, readers, it's because there is an adult in their life who reads. It is said that education is the equalizer. So what is great and what's happening in DC at the DC Public Library is that we don't just support your child coming into the library, checking out books and returning them. Of course, we want you to do that. But we also support kids building their own home libraries. So we have the program Books from Birth, where a child gets a free book to keep every month from birth up until the age of five. Then we continue that with our Beyond the Book program that I spoke about. And every quarter, you get a free book again to keep, to be part of your home library. So again, we want to continue to fill that void, whether it be the digital divide, whether if you don't have Wi-Fi or if you don't have a home computer, of course you could come to the library for that. But we also just want to make sure that when you're home, you have books that you could take right off your shelf and continue to read. Please make sure that you go to your nearest library and make sure that you take advantage of our amazing free programs, from STEM-related programs to our story times. We are there to engage your kids as well as you. There's a great amount of adult programming that happens in the public library. So I just say, if you don't know what's happening at your library, take a walk over and find out.
Shante Burns Simpson, again, the Director of Youth and Family Services at DC Public Library. Thank you so much for being with us in this hour. You and libraries and librarians are very much appreciated.
Thank you, David. And I appreciate you again for inviting me to be part of today's show.
That will do it. And I want to make a hearty thanks to Mike Nasella, our engineer of the hour, and with all due diligence, worked so hard. Mike, thank you so very much. My thanks to the News and Public Affairs Department at WPFW, to staff and fellow programmers, and importantly, you, the listener, for supporting the station. I thank you, and hopefully we'll meet again on the radio. Until then, take good care.
While Medgar Evers and Patrice Lumumba were not personally acquainted, their lives and struggles are often commemorated together due to the parallels in their commitment to fighting for the self-determination and liberation of African people. WPFW celebrates the centennial of this parallel vision with From Mississippi to the Congo, 100 Years of Lumumba and Medgar, Wednesday, July 2nd, noon until midnight on WPFW. Building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Education, art, health, music, politics, and all things community.
Yes.
Join me, Ambrose Lane Jr., as we uncover the issues of DC communities east of the river on To the East, Mondays at 5 p.m. right here on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW 89.3 FM.
We are going to march to the White House and we are going to deliver a message. Trump must go now.
This 4th of July, refusefascism.org is saying, don't celebrate Trump's fascist America. Protest. Don't barbecue with family. While immigrant families are being ripped apart, troops are in the streets, elected officials are being threatened and arrested, and fascism is advancing. No, the lesson of history is that fascism must be defeated before it becomes too late. That is why on July 4th at 2 p.m. at Logan Circle, refusefascism.org will rally and then march to the White House to declare independence from Trump's fascist America in the name of humanity. Then, right in front of the White House, they will raise the biggest chant heard round the world.
Trump must go now!
Trump must go now!
Details and to get involved, refusefascism.org. Yeah!
The Youth Resiliency Institute's annual Cherry Hill Arts and Music Waterfront Festival is back on Friday, July 4th, 1 until 10 p.m. at Middle Branch Park in Baltimore. Music, food trucks, children's activities, vendors, art exhibition, and more in celebration of the 15th anniversary of the Youth Resiliency Institute. Performers include Navasha Dea, Cecily, DJ Grin, and Fusion Orchestra, and more. Details at cherryhillfest.com or 443-813-2116. WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time.
This July 4th, WPFW presents Higher, the poetic genius of Sekou Sundiata and the musical innovation of Sly Stone, from 9 a.m. until 7 p.m. We begin at 11 a.m. with an airing of Sekou Sundiata's 51st Dream State, a multimedia meditation on empire. At 1 p.m., our multifaceted exploration of Sly Stone kicks off until 7 p.m. with tributes curated by Brother Jamil, James Funk, and DJ Lance Reynolds. Full schedule at WPFWFM.org. WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time.
Are you ready? The Birchmere presents Omar, July 17th. Hubert Laws, July 20th. Hiroshima, July 24th, and Sheila E., July 30th. Details at thebirchmere.com.
The WPFW Local Station Board's Relocation Committee is in the process of re-envisioning what studio space for a progressive, community-based, and community-supported radio station should be in the coming decade or more. We wish to ensure that a new, more permanent home will meet current needs and those less foreseeable in the future. All WPFW stakeholders, listeners, donors, programmers, staff, community activists may share their thoughts and insights about the future space by taking the location survey located on the WPFW homepage. Be creative in your answers. The future belongs to those who dream big. The survey may be found at www.wpfwfm.org. Please submit your answers by June 30th. Thank you for your thoughts and time.
Wondering how to get WPFW swag in your life?